She got the whole world running. He ain't using no pump. For sure, niggas in the back. Get smacked. He ain't no motherfucking pump. Speak up with the motherfucking issue. Don't nobody hear you. Know why? Cause you a motherfucking nigga. And the world like to get you. Jump. When the women say jump. Cause you ain't cutting no checks. So in his eyes, you a punk. Black girl got junk in the trunk. And the boss wanna hump. What you do, keep making that money. A walk out, you ain't selling your living. Hold your head up high. And thank the most high. Cause they can't disgrace your name in public. Whole world fucked up. From faggot threats to foreign collects. They call it white side of hushlin'. He got the whole world running. He ain't using no punk. For sure, niggas in the back. Get smacked. He ain't no motherfucking punk. Speak up with the motherfucking issue. Don't nobody hear you. Know why? Cause you a motherfucking nigga. And the world like to get you. He got the whole world running. He ain't using no punk. For sure, niggas in the back. Get smacked. He ain't no motherfucking punk. Speak up with the motherfucking issue. Don't nobody hear you. Know why? Cause you a motherfucking nigga. And the world like to get you. Come on, please change this goddamn episode. Cause I'm tired of seeing my people getting dead roses. They took your years and gave you bunnies. Playing with your soul, but do you manage it? Nope, and there it goes. But nigga like me is on a different degree. See the police ain't killing like me cause I walk with thee. And pray that he walk with you, me, and babies. And take care of the elderly and people for cleansing the wicked streets. Running. He ain't using no pump. For sure, niggas in the back. Get smacked. He ain't no motherfucking pump. Speak up with the motherfucking issue. Don't nobody hear you. Know why? Cause you a motherfucking nigga. And the world like to get you. You got the whole world running. And he ain't using no pump. For sure, niggas in the back. Get smacked. He ain't no motherfucking pump. Speak up with the motherfucking issue. Don't nobody hear you. Know why? Cause you're a y'all precious eye. And that's why the whole world trying to get you.
Welcome, welcome, welcome. Another edition of Mohawk Radio. This is April 28th show. I'm doing it now, April 29th, 1 a.m. in the morning. Thank the Lord for the day, the moment, and the hour. Pray that He bless the edification of His word. And may it be beneficial to us, you know? So, hey. With that, we got a pretty healthy show today. Getting right back on track. Said that I had a couple of shows planned and lined up. Now being able to bring back out the lineup. But just the show from yesterday, the earlier show, that was kind of a good insert that the Lord actually had, and it just played out that way. Because it all helped to be a building factor to the information that we're going to get into today. As far as connecting dots, relationships, you know, back to the American Banknote Company and how little small stages become big impactful things in and around the world. So, because we got a healthy show, I'm not going to hold too long. I'm going to go ahead and get into the first one. Quantum computers. We were talking earlier about the COVID-19 and the people trying to restructure because they see this being a new way of life, being that they're saying it's going to come back and things like that. Everybody trying to prepare themselves before they begin to shift business back into full operation gear, hiring people as far as the new hire models, any, you know, technical solution that may be replacing those and things like that. So along that line, so we're about to get into it. Mohawk Radio.
Quantum computers use the natural world to produce machines with staggeringly powerful processing potential.
I think it's going to be the most important computing technology of this century, which we are really just about one-fifth into.
We could use quantum computers to simulate molecules to build new drugs and new materials, and to solve problems plaguing physicists for decades. Wall Street could use them to optimize portfolios, simulate economic forecasts, and for complex risk analysis. Quantum computing could also help scientists speed up discoveries in adjacent fields like machine learning and artificial intelligence. Amazon, Google, IBM, and Microsoft, plus a host of smaller companies such as Rigetti and D-Wave, are all betting big on quantum.
If you were a billionaire, how many of your billions would you give over for an extra 10 years of life? There are some simply astonishing financial opportunities in quantum computing. This is why there's so much interest, even though it's so far down the road.
But nothing is ever a sure thing, and dealing with the quirky nature of quantum physics create some big hurdles for this nascent technology.
From the very beginning, it was, you know, understood that building a useful quantum computer was going to be a staggeringly hard engineering problem, if it was even possible at all. Right? And there were even distinguished physicists in the 90s who said, this will never work.
Is quantum truly the next big thing in computing? Or is it destined to become something more like nuclear fusion? Destined to always be the technology of the future, never the present. In October 2019, Google made a big announcement. Google said it had achieved quantum supremacy. That's the moment when quantum computers can beat out the world's most powerful supercomputers for certain tasks.
They've demonstrated with the quantum computer that it can perform a computation in seconds, what would take the world's fastest supercomputer years, thousands of years, to do that same calculation. And in the field, this is known as quantum supremacy, and it's a really important milestone.
Google used a 53-qubit processor named Sycamore to complete the computation, a completely arbitrary mathematical problem with no real-world application. The Google quantum computer spit out an answer in about 200 seconds. It would have taken the world's fastest computer around 10,000 years to come up with a solution, according to Google scientists. With that, Google claimed it had won the race to quantum supremacy. But IBM had an issue with the findings. Yes. IBM, the storied tech company that helped usher in giant mainframes and personal computing, it's a major player in quantum computing. IBM said one of its massive supercomputer networks, this one at the Oak Ridge National Laboratories in Tennessee, could simulate a quantum computer and theoretically solve the same problem in a matter of days, not the 10,000 years that Google had claimed. Either way, it was a huge milestone for quantum computers. And Silicon Valley is taking notice. Venture capital investors are pouring hundreds of millions of dollars into quantum computing startups, even though practical applications are years or even decades away. By 2019, private investors have backed at least 52 quantum technology companies around the world since 2012, according to an analysis by Nature. Many of them were spun out of research teams at universities. In 2017 and 2018, companies received at least $450 million in private funding, more than four times the funding from the previous 2 years. That's nowhere near the amount of funding going into a field like artificial intelligence. About $9.3 billion worth of venture capital money poured into AI firms in 2018. But the growth in quantum computing funding is happening quickly for an industry without a real application yet.
Now, it is not easy to figure out how to actually use a quantum computer to do something useful, right? So Nature gives you this very, very bizarre hammer in the form of this interference effect among all of these amplitudes, right? And it's up to us as quantum computer scientists to figure out what nails that hammer can hit.
That's leading to some backlash against the hype and concern that quantum computing could soon become a bubble and then dry up just as fast if progress stalls. Quantum computers are also notoriously fickle. They need tightly controlled environments to operate in. Changes in nearby temperatures and electromagnetic waves can cause them to mess up. And then there's the temperature of the quantum chips themselves. They need to be kept at temperatures colder than interstellar space, close to absolute zero. One of the central tenets of quantum physics is called superposition. That means a subatomic particle, like an electron, can exist in two different states at the same time. It was, and still, is super hard for normal computers to simulate quantum mechanics because of superposition.
Now, it was only in the early 80s that a few physicists, such as Richard Feynman, had the amazing suggestion that if nature is giving us that computational lemon, well, why not make it into lemonade?
You've probably heard or read this explanation of how a quantum computer works. Regular or classical computers run on bits. Bits can either be a one or a zero. Quantum computers, on the other hand, run on quantum bits, or qubits. Qubits can be either one or zero, or both, or a combination of the two at the same time. That's not wrong per se, but it only scratches the surface according to Scott Aronson, who teaches computer science and quantum computing at the University of Texas in Austin. We asked him to explain how quantum computing actually works.
Well, let me start with this. You never hear your weather forecaster say, well, you know, there's a negative 30% chance of rain tomorrow, right? That would just be nonsense, right? The chance of something happening is always between 0% and 100%. Okay, but now quantum mechanics is based on numbers called amplitudes. Amplitudes can be positive or negative. In fact, they can even be complex numbers involving the square root of negative one. So a qubit is a bit that has an amplitude for being zero and another amplitude for being one.
The goal for quantum computers is to make sure the amplitudes leading to wrong answers cancel each other out, and that scientists reading the output of the quantum computers are left with amplitudes leading to the right answer of whatever problem they're trying to solve. So, what does a quantum computer look like in the real world? The quantum computers developed by companies such as Google, IBM, and Rigetti were all made using a process called superconducting.
Okay, and this is where you have a chip the size of an ordinary computer chip, and you have little coils of wire in the chip, you know, which are actually quite enormous by the standards of qubits. They're, you know, nearly big enough to see with the naked eye. Okay, but you can have two different quantum states of current that are flowing through these coils that correspond to a zero or a one. And of course, you can also have superpositions of the two. Now, the coil can interact with each other, via something called Joseph's injunctions. Okay, so they're laid out in roughly a rectangular array, and the nearby ones can talk to each other and thereby, you know, generate these very complicated states, what we call entangled states, which is one of the essentials of quantum computing. And the way that the qubits interact with each other is fully programmable. Okay, so you can send electrical signals to the chip to say which qubits should interact with each other ones at which time. Now, in order for this to work, the whole chip is placed in a dilution refrigerator that's the size of a closet, roughly, and it cools it to about a hundredth of a degree above absolute zero. That's where you get the superconductivity that allows these bits to briefly behave as qubits.
At IBM's research lab in Yorktown Heights, New York, the big tech company houses several quantum computers already hooked up to the cloud. Corporate clients such as Goldman Sachs and JP Morgan are part of IBM's Q network, where they can experiment with the quantum machines and their programming language. So far, it's a way for companies to get used to quantum computing rather than make money from it. Quantum computers need exponentially more qubits before they start doing anything useful. IBM recently unveiled a 53-qubit computer, the same size as Google's Sycamore processor.
We think we're actually going to need tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of qubits to get to real business problems. So you can see we need quite a lot of advances, and doubling every year, or perhaps even a little faster, is what we need to get us there. That's why it's 10 years out, at least.
Quantum computing would need to see some big advances between then and now. Bigger advances than what occurred during the timeline of classical computing and Moore's Law.
Oh, we need better than Moore's Law. Moore's Law was doubling every 2 years. We're talking doubling every year, with occasionally some really big jumps.
So once quantum computers become useful, what can they do? Scientists first came up with the idea for quantum computers as a way to better simulate quantum mechanics. That's still the main purpose for them, and it also holds the most money-making potential.
So one example is the caffeine molecule. Now, if you're like me, you've probably ingested billions or trillions of caffeine molecules so far today. Now, if computers are really that good, right, really that powerful, and we have these tremendous supercomputers that are out there, we should be able to really take a molecule and represent it exactly in a computer. And this would be great for many fields: healthcare, pharmaceuticals, creating new materials, creating new flavorings, right? Anywhere where molecules are in play. So if we just start with this basic idea of caffeine, it turns out it's absolutely impossible to represent one simple little caffeine molecule in a classical computer, because the amount of information you would need to represent it, the number of zeros and ones you would need, is around 10 to the 48th. The number of atoms on the Earth are about 10 to 100 times that number. So in the worst case, one caffeine molecule could use 10% of all the atoms in the Earth, just for storage. That's never going to happen. However, if we have a quantum computer with 160 qubits, and this is a model of a 50-qubit machine behind me, you can kind of figure, well, if we make good progress, eventually we'll get up to 160 good qubits. It looks like we'll be able to do something with caffeine on a quantum computer, and it's never going to be possible on a classical computer.
Another potential use comes from Wall Street: complex risk analysis and economic forecasting. Quantum computing also has big potential for portfolio optimization. Perhaps the biggest business opportunity out of quantum computing in the short term is simply preparing for the widespread use of them. Companies and governments are already attempting to quantum-proof their most sensitive data and secrets. In 1994, a scientist at Bell Labs named Peter Shor came up with an algorithm that proved quantum computers could factor huge numbers much more quickly than their classical counterparts. That also means quantum computers, if powerful and efficient enough, could theoretically break RSA encryption. RSA is the type of encryption that underpins the entire internet. Quantum computers, the way they're built now, would need millions of qubits to crack RSA cryptography. But that milestone could be 20 or 30 years away, and governments and companies are beginning to get ready for it.
You know, for a lot of people, that doesn't matter. But for example, for health records, if health records could be opened up, that could compromise all kinds of things: government communications, banking records. Sometimes even banking records from decades ago contain important information that you don't want suppose. So the problem we've got is we don't really know when quantum computers will be able to do this, or even if we'll ever build one big enough to do this. But what we do know is if you don't update your cryptography now, all the messages that you send over the next few years, the ones you in history, could potentially be read. What this means is, for example, if you're a Cisco selling networking equipment, you're going to need to offer quantum-safe encryption as an option in the very near future. Because even though it doesn't look like you need it right away, if your product doesn't have it and a competitor does, guess which product gets bought?
One big issue facing quantum computing, other than increasing the number of qubits while keeping things stable, is that no one actually knows the best way to build a quantum computer yet. The quantum computers at Google and IBM and other companies show off are very much still experiments. There's also a big education gap. Not many people are studying quantum computing yet. China is pouring billions into quantum computing education, and the U.S. Congress passed a law in 2018 called the National Quantum Initiative Act in order to help catch up.
Quantum computing capable people will be a rare commodity, which means that you want to invest in them now. You want to be hiring people with quantum computing knowledge, not necessarily to do quantum computing, but because you want that intelligence in your organization so that you can take advantage of it when it shows up. Now, China, with its promise to put $10 billion in, is really upping the stakes in terms of the number of Chinese quantum physics PhDs that are going to start appearing. And you know, if that hair restoration or life extension drug happened to be property of the Chinese government, what does that do to the world economy? That's much more powerful than making war.
Other experts have compared Google's announcement to Sputnik, the Soviet satellite launched into orbit in 1957. The beach ball-sized satellite was the first man-made object to orbit the Earth. But Sputnik didn't really do anything useful other than prove launching something into space was possible.
Many people are surprised that where exactly we are. For those who are just getting started, they like to make noise about vacuum tubes and Sputnik and things like this. But let me give you some numbers. IBM has had quantum computers on the cloud for 3.5 years, since May of 2016. We're not in any sort of Sputnik era. We're not landing on the moon. But for those of you who like space history, I think we're probably well into Mercury or Gemini.
That was good information, wasn't it? Quantum computing. What does that got to do with anything? We're going to keep it pushing. I ain't going to hold it too long. But hey, before we move forward, U.S. Mobile Technology Company, InterDigital signs patent license agreement with China's Huawei. Yeah, that's the same people that was spying, right? But while all that's going on, they got your president begging for your meat factories to be open again so you'll have food. Restaurants selling directly to consumers. You got health consumer reports saying that could be deadly. America's topping 1 million as far as the corona death toll. But, you know, they sweep things such as InterDigital and Huawei. You know, you get that on the tail end of everything else that you get, right? It's a reason for that. Maybe you should question the reason for that, right? But, energy, you know, channeling your energy, you know, the mind is such a terrible thing to waste, isn't it? But a digital mind, it's one way to get people trapped in the net. But when you get them trapped in the net, how do you then take that energy and you channel it into what your real objective is? But in order to understand how to channel something into a new direction, you have to have a new direction. You have to know what direction you're going in. You have to know why you're going in that direction. A lot of things that you have to know, being in the know, a lot of people don't know. But as far as quantum computing, the things that you're voluntarily signing up for, your Facebooks, your Twitters, your Instagrams, you use these things over and over and over and over and over again, and you're building your own prison. You know, you're building your own database. You're telling people how to interact with you. You're telling them what ticks you, what gets you going, what turns you off, all of that stuff. And they don't have to steal the information anymore because you voluntarily turn it over to them. But after you turn it over to them, what do they do with it? Because all of that information and stuff, it's not just the information. They use the information against you, but the fact that you took the time out to upload it, you took the time out to watch it, to like it, to comment on it, all of that stuff, that's energy. And that's being deposited into your spiritual bank account. You see what I'm saying? So it's either a plus one or a negative one. You know, so what are they using their energy for? Quantum computing. There's a reason why they're building all this stuff. It's deeper than the chip, but the chip has something to do with it. All of it is intertwined with one another. Even back to the Corona consulting. How do you get past the Corona virus? Or how do you position yourself in business to move forward past this? You see what I'm saying? Those are questions that people are asking. They're real questions. And all of these things go back to ideas that are being discussed with people that are in corporations or that are in shell corporations, which could be an ID subsidiary, which could be an ID parent holding company, subsidiary holding company for another holding company. Could, I mean, just be a LLC. It really doesn't matter. A single person, sole proprietorship. I mean, we really don't know what we're investing in. We believe we're investing in big corporations, and they are. But who's behind the big corporation? Because there's always a big fish. But that paper trail, you have to follow it in order to get a complete understanding of what's going on. So Banknote Corporation of America and them investing in things such as the art textiles company. And then you have your high-end fashion houses and things that spark off from them. You see, and you don't think that it has a play on society. Those high-end fashion houses come into museums, and then they go into high-end Broadway theaters, you know, all of that beautiful stuff. But how do they take a paper dollar and convert it into a digital dollar? You see, all of this stuff plays into one another. You know, supercomputing, you getting into it, major world event, getting people to accept the chip. But it's all about energy, energy, energy. Your mind is a terrible thing to waste. So I'm not going to linger any longer. We're going to go ahead and move on to the next phase of this here, because it's all building blocks, and we finna get to the major, major, major part of this. Real talk, more art radio.
The Large Hadron Collider is the largest and most powerful atom smasher in the world. Built to hunt for new particles and probe the fundamental forces of nature, this massive machine is a 27-kilometer underground loop filled with supercooled magnets and massive detectors that whip particles at the highest speeds possible to eventually collide into each other. And during one famous sprint in 2012, particles collided and the Higgs boson was officially discovered.
I would like to add my congratulations to everybody involved in this tremendous achievement.
The Higgs is a special particle. Its presence confirmed the existence of an invisible quantum field that's responsible for giving particles their mass. This field permeates the universe, leading some to suspect that the Higgs may play an important role in the origin of everything. But at this point, the Large Hadron Collider and the community that built it are at a crossroads. Physicists haven't found the supersymmetry particles they were hoping to see. If they did, it would have solved some open mysteries we have about the Higgs and the inner workings of the universe. This has created a huge international debate over what to do next. For many at CERN, the institution that runs the Large Hadron Collider, the next step in the hunt for new physics is to build an even bigger machine.
People expected for 40 years before the Higgs was discovered that the Higgs could not be a lonely elementary particle. It would have to come along with a lot of other things in order to give a coherent sort of rational explanation for the origin of its mass. And the big surprise since July 4th, 2012, when the Higgs was triumphantly discovered, is that that has not happened. So that's really sort of four decades of a certain paradigm for what's going on with the physics associated with the Higgs that has not worked out the way theorists imagined that it would. And that's kind of fascinating. I think the last time something of this degree of surprise happened to theoretical physics, probably a little over 100 years ago, what nature has in mind for what the Higgs is about is something different than what theorists had in mind. While theorists are very confused about it, the program for experimentalists is completely clear. When you run into a kind of elementary particle you've never seen before, you've never seen anything like it anywhere in physics before, you just put the damn thing under a microscope and you study it to death.
It's pretty remarkable that we need to build enormous machines that produce an incredible amount of energy to probe the smallest things in the universe. And the push towards higher collision energies to discover new particles is connected to Albert Einstein's famous equation, E equals mc squared.
There's an equivalence here between energy on one side and mass on the other side. When we collide two particles, we gain access to the kinetic energy they carry. And out of this kinetic energy, new particles can be made according to Einstein's relation. And of course, the higher the energy that we bring into this collision, the higher the mass of a particle that is forming out of this energy can be.
To get more juice out of the machine, CERN shut the LHC down for performance upgrades. They're working on cranking up the luminosity.
Luminosity is a measure for the quality of a collider, and in some sense, it tells you how many collisions per second this collider can provide.
When two of the elementary particles have kind of a head-on collision, and you can tell that that happened because the results of the collisions come out at larger angles relative to the beams, but it's still an incredibly messy and kind of complicated environment. And even when we produce new elementary particles like the Higgs, they don't come out wearing a name tag saying, I am a Higgs. They decay in a blink of an eye. It's the results of those decays that then our experimental colleagues have to sort of sift through like looking for a needle in a haystack in order to actually see the evidence.
This luminosity upgrade would ultimately produce more collisions and would make measurements of particles like the Higgs even more accurate. Once completed in 2026, it'll produce an estimated 15 million Higgs per year, compared to the 3 million in 2017.
It will be very beneficial to operate this infrastructure until about 2035 or 2040. And by then, we will have collected such a huge amount of data from the collisions that we somehow saturate the knowledge that can be provided by this machine. Operating it 5 years longer or 10 years longer will not give significantly more information, which means for particle physicists that the useful time of life of this accelerator will be reached.
These timescales seem way out in the future, but to put this in perspective, planning for the Large Hadron Collider began back in the 1980s, construction was approved in 1994, and the first runs didn't start until 2008. So to prepare for what comes next, teams are delivering conceptual designs for next-generation particle machines. There are proposals for an international linear collider, which Japan just backed out on. China has a circular collider project, and there's one from CERN.
I'm in charge of the future circular collider study. What we were working on is not an upgrade of the LHC machine, it's really new machines to come after the LHC era, so from 2040 onwards.
It'll take international collaboration, billions of dollars, and scientists to invent tools that don't even exist yet. First things first, though, CERN wants a bigger tunnel.
Well, on a map, you can imagine you have a circle, which is the LHC, and then you would put a new circle that is roughly four times larger. The whole existing CERN accelerator complex, including the LHC, would serve as a pre-accelerator for such a future 100-kilometer machine, like the gearbox in a car. Yeah? If you want to drive very fast, you must have several gears. You start in a small gear at low velocity, and once you accelerate, you go to the second gear, third gear, fourth gear, fifth gear. This thing is very similar. We would start with small accelerators at low energy, and then we go larger, 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 and higher energy, higher energy, higher energy.
The CERN study presents a path forward to achieve these energy gear shifts. There's a new lepton collider, which collides electrons and positrons, a more advanced hadron collider, which collides protons and protons, and then heavy ions, and then a third option, an electron-proton collider.
The big difference between an electron and the proton, which are the two particles that we have for these colliders, is essentially that the electron and its antiparticle, the positron, are point-like particles that, to our present knowledge, have no substructure.
When we say that the electron looks point-like, but the proton does not, it actually means if you bounce things off the electron, you see that the way photons bounce off of it are just as if the electron had no substructure of any sort. Who knows? If we imagine probing things with microscopes that are a million times stronger than anything that we've seen in some alien civilization that's a million times stronger than the LHC, maybe we would see substructure to the electron too. Okay? Or if you believe string theorists, if we look at ridiculously short distances, everything is made out of some little loop of string. So in what sense are things elementary or composite?
But that's a story for another day.
The Higgs is kind of point-like. And that's just not good enough for us to sort of really settle this theoretically dramatic question.
We can try to measure all the known particles, like the Higgs particle, the W and the Z particle and the top quark with the best precision possible. And for this, you would build this lepton collider, because the lepton collider could produce exactly these particles in a very clean environment, in huge numbers. The electrons are super clean for collisions, but we cannot reach extremely high energies. The protons are a bit more dirty in the collision, but we can accelerate them to far, far higher energies.
Unlike the electron, a proton is not an elementary particle.
The proton is a kind of a big, messy object that's made up out of these smaller, as far as we can tell, fundamental constituents known as quarks that are held together inside the proton by the imaginatively named gluon. When we smash protons into each other at incredibly high energies, one set is going this way at 0.9999999, that's 7 nines, the speed of light. The other is going the other way, same number of nine times the speed of light. And when they smash into each other, mostly they go splat, and the debris of the collision goes in the direction of the beams we're coming in.
The next generation hadron collider would smash protons together like the LHC, except it'd reach energies of 100 trillion electron volts.
The Hadron Collider would provide much higher collision energies that would allow direct creation of today not known particles.
This boosted machine could be used as a tool to search for theoretical particles like WIMPs, which are connected to dark matter. It's one of the most abundant and mysterious forms of matter in the universe, and we haven't detected it directly yet. We might be able to, and answer other big questions, by upping the power and tweaking the detector's precision.
Factor 100 precision is what we need to decisively settle the question of whether the Higgs looks more point-like than anything we've seen before as far as its probes, how it interacts with other particles. Factor of 10 higher in energy will let us produce billions of Higgses. 100 TeV is what we need to settle this question of the simplest possible model of weakly interacting massive particles.
The natural sequence is clearly to start with a lepton collider, which is also a machine that is today technically ready for construction, and in parallel to the operation and the physics analysis of this machine, you can use the time to develop the very high field superconducting magnets that you need for the successor machine. The magnets that we have presently operating in the LHC tunnel can only reach 8 or 9 Tesla, which is the magnetic field strength, so we want to double this to 16 or even higher. Magnets is, in this case, the really big challenge for such a project. All these things need to be addressed from the very beginning in small setups, because you do not want to build 15-meter-long heavy magnets every time to test something new.
While this project is an incredible scientific endeavor, the price tag is very steep. These future colliders could cost over $20 billion and would need investment from the international community to even get off the ground.
For this decision process, I mean, there are several aspects, of course. There's a scientific political one, there's an economical one, there's of course also a physics community process. And this is exactly what is starting now. There's a bottom-up opinion-making process, which is taking place in Europe in the coming year.
While the discussions continue, some have even questioned whether an investment like this is even the right course forward for the particle physics community. There are questions over whether the science case is as strong, if investing in this project is worth the cost compared to other global issues, and how we can be so sure a machine of this magnitude can answer these big questions.
There's a spectrum of possibilities for what could be out there theoretically, and so we can't know until we look. What's definitely true is that no one who's arguing for building these next machines is now saying we should build them because we expect to see particle X. We should build them because supersymmetry is around the corner, or extra dimensions around the corner, or anything like that. If you believe that the purpose of doing these experiments is making new particles, it's definitely time to take your ball and go home and do something else with your life, because it cannot be guaranteed at all. And I think this is one of the most profound things there is to say about this sort of human adventure of science, period, which is that everyone who works in fundamental science has the sense that we're exploring something that's out there, and something that's much, much larger than each one of us individually. So there's this gigantic structure out there in the universe. It knows vastly more about the laws of nature than we do. It is nature. By studying it, we put ourselves in the neighborhood of something that's vastly more powerful, vastly deeper than any of us are individually. The only method that we know of to have access to this tremendous power and depth, far beyond what any of us have individually, is to interact with it. And I think that's the ultimate source of real magic that goes well beyond what humans are capable of now, is out there in the structure of the universe. And we only can find what it is by interacting with it and studying it.
Trying to make sure my doubt didn't have a little something extra on him. You know what I'm saying? Because he was going off. You know, he was going all the way off. You know, respectfully. A lot of people might not want to hear me say that, but that young nigga was going off. I'm talking about all the way off the road. I don't know where he was going, but he was out there. You see what I'm saying? All the way out there. Quantum computing is all the way out there. You're giving your information to Facebook and Twitter and Google and everybody else. You know, that shit was unheard of a couple of generations ago, you know. Old folk told you, stop talking so much. Stop telling everything. You know what I'm saying? Mind your business. You know what I'm saying? People learn how to develop them some business by themselves and keep it to themselves. Now today, the whole goddamn world feel like, damn, nigga, you supposed to share everything with me. Share your information with me, share your money with me, share your girl with me, I share my girl with you. You share your nigga with me, I share my nigga, you know what I'm saying? Just like that. You know, the world just freely sharing everything. Except for what is to be shared, right? You know, but I mean, there was a lot of open-ended sentences. A lot of closed captured questions, you know, a lot of double talk, you see what I'm saying, a lot of double talk, you know, we could just get to the heart of the matter and just go on head straight to what it is, you see what I'm saying, but we don't want to get to the heart of the matter, what it is, we like to, you know, pussyfoot around, you know what I'm saying, and continue to, you know, persuade others to go along with the course of the program, you know, and it's about to start, people. You know, they're about to start handing out brochures real soon. You see the connection. It's all about the energy. You know, one of the kings, Papa Duck, had a video about ley lines. I'm going to try to pull it out, you know, and link that as the video to see what one of these. Brother Judah was talking about the comet in the sky. And he's been having eyes on the skies. I need to check on BP Earthwatch, see what he's looking at. But, see, I wasn't aware of those things. You see, this was supposed to be the show that came before the show that is now the show that is before this one. But the Lord put it in play for that show to go before this one. And just the course of the entire program. Welcome, because it's being handed out. And so, what is on the program, you ask? That is a very, very good question. Ley lines, we're going to leave that so that we can understand energy a little bit more, the relationships. We plant seeds because we have now realized that that the mind is a terrible thing to waste. So we're not going to waste the mind anymore. You know, we're going to start making good use of it, you know, because we understand not being wasteful. You know, we're seeing the benefit of being productive. So, what is the production that is on the way? Well, why don't we take a look at the program, shall we? More radio.
This episode of Real Engineering is brought to you by Brilliant, a problem-solving website that teaches you to think like an engineer. On the 24th of May, SpaceX launched a Falcon 9 rocket filled with 60 satellites into space. This marked the beginning of their ambitious new project called Starlink, which aims to provide high-quality broadband internet to the most isolated parts of the planet, while also providing low-latency connectivity to already well-connected cities. SpaceX aimed to make their broadband as accessible as possible, claiming that anyone will be able to connect to their network if they buy the pizza box-sized antenna, which SpaceX is developing themselves. This launch of 60 satellites was just the first of many. SpaceX has 12,000 satellites planned for launch over the next decade, dramatically increasing the total amount of spacecraft around Earth's orbit. This will cost SpaceX billions of dollars, so they must have a good reason for doing so. Let's see how this network will work and how it will compete with existing internet providers. Back in 2015, Elon announced that SpaceX had begun working on a communication satellite network, stating that there is a significant unmet demand for low-cost global broadband capabilities. Around that time, SpaceX opened a new facility in Redmond, Washington, to develop and manufacture these new communication satellites. The initial plan was to launch two prototype satellites into orbit by 2016 and have the initial satellite constellation up and running by 2020. But the company struggled to develop a receiver that could be easily installed by the user for a low cost. This delayed the program, and the initial prototype satellites weren't launched until 2018. After a successful launch of the two prototypes, Tintin A and B, which allowed SpaceX to test and refine their satellite design, SpaceX kept pretty quiet about what was next for the Starlink project, until November 2018, when SpaceX received approval from the FCC to deploy 7,500 satellites into orbit, on top of the 4,400 that were already approved. On May 24th, the first batch of production satellites were launched into orbit, and people around the world quickly started to spot the train of satellites moving across the night sky. This launch is a sign of things to come. While this initial group of satellites are not fully functional, they will be used to test things like the Earth communication systems and the Krypton thrusters, which will be used to autonomously avoid debris and deorbit the spacecraft once it has reached the end of its life cycle. Let's look at these functionalities first. We have explored how ion thrusters work in the past, which you can watch for more detail, but essentially they use electric potential to fire ions out of the spacecraft to provide propulsion. Xenon is ideally used because it has a high atomic mass, allowing it to provide more kick per atom, while being inert and having a high storage density, lending itself to long-term storage on a spacecraft. However, SpaceX opted for krypton, as xenon's rarity makes it a far more expensive propellant. This ion thruster will initially be used to raise the Starlink satellites from their release orbits of 440 kilometers to their final orbital height of 550 kilometers. They will also be used in conjunction with the onboard control momentum gyroscopes located here, and the US government's Space Debris Collision Prediction System to allow the satellites to adjust their orbits to dodge collisions, which we have also spoken about in more detail in a previous video. When the satellites have reached the end of their service life, they can then use the same attitude controls and thrusters to deorbit the satellite. SpaceX have included all the necessary hardware to minimize space debris risk. In their Federal Communications Commission approval application, they claim that 95% of the satellite will burn up on re-entry, with only the ion thruster internal structure and silicon carbide components standing a chance of survival. Those silicon carbide components are likely to survive as they are essential materials for the operation of lasers and thus have an extremely high melting point of 2750 degrees. Which brings us to our communications abilities, the primary function of the satellite. SpaceX have been tight-lipped on many of the details of the satellite, but thanks to the FCC filing, we know that the satellites will contain five 1.5 kilogram silicon carbide components, which indicates that each satellite will contain five individual lasers. These lasers, like our fiber optic cables here on Earth, will use light pulses to transmit information between satellites. Transmitting with light in space offers one massive advantage over transmitting with light here on Earth, however. The speed of light is not constant in every material. In fact, light travels 47% slower in glass than in a vacuum. This offers Starlink one huge advantage that will likely be its primary money maker. It provides the potential for lower latency information over long distance. In simpler terms, let's imagine this as a race between data packets. A user in London wants the new adjusted price for a stock on the Nasdaq from the New York Stock Exchange. If this information were to use a typical route, let's say through the AC2 cable, which has a return journey of about 12,800 kilometers to make through our glass fiber optic cable, in a vacuum, light travels at a speed of 299,792,458 meters per second. The speed of travel in glass depends on the refractive index, and the refractive index depends on the wavelength, but we will take the reduction as 1.47 times slower than the speed of light in a vacuum. This means the data packet will take roughly 0.063 seconds to make the round trip, and thus has a latency of 0.063 seconds, or 62.7 milliseconds. With the additional steps that add to this latency, like the conversion of light signals to electrical signals on either end of the optical cable, traffic queues, and the transfer to our final computer terminal, this total time comes out at about 76 milliseconds. Figuring out the latency for Starlink is a lot more difficult, as we have no real-world measurements to go by, but we can make some educated guesses with the help of Mark Handley, a communications professor in University College London. The first source of latency for Starlink will be during the up and downlink process, where we need to transfer our information to and from Earth. We know this will be done with phase array antenna, which are radio antenna which can control the direction of their transmission without moving parts. Instead, they use destructive and constructive interference to control the direction of the radio wave. Each satellite has a cone beam with an 81 degree range of view. With an orbit of 550 kilometers, each satellite can cover a circular area with a radius of 500 kilometers. At SpaceX's originally planned orbit, this coverage had a radius of 1,060 kilometers. Lowering the altitude of a satellite decreases the area it can cover, but also decreases the latency. This is particularly noticeable for typical communication satellites operating in geostationary orbit at an altitude of 36,000 kilometers. The time it takes data to travel up to the satellite and back down, traveling at the speed of light, is around 240 milliseconds, 369% slower than our subsea cable. However, since Starlink is intending to operate at a much lower altitude, the up and downlink theoretical latency could be as low as 3.6 milliseconds. This is why SpaceX needs so many satellites in their constellation in order to provide worldwide coverage. Each individual Starlink satellite has four phased array antennae located here, 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 and here. This directional beam was an essential part of SpaceX's FCC approval application, as thousands of satellites broadcasting undirected radio waves would cause significant amounts of interference with other communication methods. Once that data is received by one Starlink satellite, it can begin to transmit that information between satellites using lasers. Each time we hop from satellites, there will be a small delay as the laser light is converted to an electric signal and back again, but it is too minuscule to consider. Things get tricky here with using lasers, as we need to accurately hit the receiver on neighboring satellites to transmit that data. Let's look at SpaceX's proposed constellation to see how this will work. SpaceX's first phase of 1,584 satellites will occupy 24 orbital planes, with 66 satellites in each plane inclined at 53 degrees. This will look something like this. Communications between neighboring satellites in the same orbital plane is relatively simple, as these satellites will remain in relatively stable positions in relation to each other. This gives us a solid line of communication along a single orbital plane. But in many cases, a single orbital plane will not connect two locations. So we need to be able to transfer information between these planes too. This requires precise tracking, as the satellites traveling in neighboring orbital planes are traveling incredibly quickly and will come in and out of view. This means the Starlink satellite will need to switch to a new satellite in the network. This can take time. The best figure I could find is about a minute for the European Space Agency's Data Relay Satellite System, which is a currently operating geostationary internet constellation designed to serve European imaging satellites and other time-critical applications, such as serving emergency forces in remote areas like those fighting forest fires. Starlink may be faster, but it won't be instantaneous, and thus it has five optical communication systems on board to maintain a steady connection to four satellites at all times. If we now use this system transmitting from New York to London and back with the shortest path possible, using the speed of light in a vacuum as our transfer speed, we can achieve a latency as low as 43 milliseconds. Even if we took the shortest route possible with an optic fiber, which does not exist, this would take about 55 milliseconds, a 28% decrease in speed. The actual current return trip time for your average Joe is about 76 milliseconds, as we saw earlier, a 77% decrease in speed. This is a huge deal for the two financial markets working out of these cities. With millions of dollars being moved in fractions of a second, having a lower latency would provide a massive advantage in capitalizing on price swings. In fact, it wouldn't be the first time a communications company has made a massive investment to specifically serve these groups. The Hibernian Express cable is a privately owned optic cable that is currently the lowest latency connection between the NY4 data center in Syracuse, New Jersey, and the LD4 data center in Slough, England, at just 59.95 milliseconds, 39.4% slower than our best time with Starlink. The previous best time was held by the AC-1 cable at 65 milliseconds. At a cost of $300 million, this 5 millisecond increase in speed was justified to just connect across the Atlantic. Imagine how much these time-sensitive industries will be willing to pay for a 17 millisecond increase in speed. It becomes even more valuable when you realize this time differential increases with increased transmission distance. New York to London is a relatively short distance. The improvements would be even more pronounced for a London to Singapore transmission. For every additional kilometer we travel, the potential gains in speed increase rapidly. But SpaceX aren't just planning on serving this super-fast internet to some customers. They primarily advertise this system as a way to connect every human on this planet to the internet, and they should have plenty of bandwidth left over to serve these people. Although the internet has been one of the fastest growing technologies in human history, by the end of 2019, more than half the world's population will still be offline. Users will connect to this internet using a Starlink terminal, which will cost around $200 each. This will still be far outside the purchasing power of many third world citizens, But it's a start, and vastly cheaper than similar currently available receivers like the Chimeta version at a price of $30,000. Elon Musk says that these will be flat enough to fit onto the roof of a car and other vehicles like ships and aeroplanes. This will allow Starlink to compete with traditional internet providers. It's estimated that moving the US from a 4G to a 5G wireless connection will cost around $150 billion in fiber optic cabling alone over the next 7 years. SpaceX planned to complete their entire Starlink project for as little as $10 billion. Each Starlink satellite cost around $300,000, which is already a massive cut in cost for communication satellites. SpaceX are also saving on launch costs as they are launching on their own Falcon 9 rockets, something no other satellite manufacturer has. If everything goes to plan, Starlink is estimated to generate $30 billion to $50 billion in revenue each year on the back of premium stock exchange memberships, demolishing their current annual revenue of around $3 billion. And this is a vital part of Elon Musk's long-term goals. The money generated from Starlink will mean SpaceX will have vastly more funding than NASA, which could go on to fund research and development of new rockets and the technologies needed to monetize lunar and Martian colonies. For now, the project is simply aiming to connect the world even more and potentially open avenues for education for third world countries that do not have adequate connections to the internet. Widely available internet will help solve this problem. And platforms like Brilliant have taken great steps to remedy this through their high-quality interactive math and science learning courses. Brilliant has helped thousands of users realize their potential in math and science, and it's stories like this why I am proud to promote Brilliant every month. They have a huge number of courses that will allow you to educate yourself, from foundational math courses to courses tailored for you to ace the American Mathematics Competition, with others geared for computer science and physics. Brilliant recently introduced a new feature called Daily Challenges, which will present you with interesting scientific and mathematical problems to test your brain every day. If I have inspired you and you want to educate yourself, then go to brilliant.org/realengineering and sign up for free. And the first 500 people to go to that link will get 20% off the annual premium subscription, so you can get full access to all their courses as well as their entire Daily Challenges archive. As always, thanks for watching and thank you to all my Patreon supporters. If you'd like to see more from me, the links to my Instagram, Twitter, subreddit, and Discord server are below.
You know, there was some good information. I follow that channel there a lot. I can't remember what channel it is at the moment. First clip about quantum computing came from CNBC. Second clip about CERN came from, I believe it was CERN themselves. No. That was CNBC also. CNBC International, as a matter of fact. Just the SpaceX one. I don't have the information right here in front of me right now. I want to say, I don't know, it might have been a window of production. I'm not sure. I'll look into it. Try to get back to you on it. A lot of in and out and in, you know. They pretty much told you how these things connect to one another. At the end, they had a little advertisement plug-in from Brilliant. You know, go over there, check it out. You know, but I don't like to advise people to put all their eggs in one basket. Sometimes it's good with certain things when you categorize things, but still don't have all your eggs in one basket. Now you can categorize something, put those in one basket, categorize things, put those in another basket. But see, diversify your portfolio. Yeah, I like that. Diversifying your portfolio. Because by doing so, you will become a lot more well-rounded and having skills in the game is the thing that makes you valuable, you know. You see, these people are in a connect. See, they told us how they were connected to one another. You know, they did. Came out of their mouth. So I won't press that issue. But the issue that I stand to press is relations. You know, relationships. How does things relate one to another, from another to another? Reopening the economy here in Georgia. How does all of the things that were open relate to one another? Who's the target audience? You know, that's something that should be questioned because it's questionable. Energy. You know, controlling our energy, knowing what we're giving it to. Why are the things are the way that they are? How does everything interconnect with one another? What does all this have to do with anything? Project Blue Beam. You see, the Lord said they're going to try to play tricks in the sky. Well, before they play tricks in the sky, they got to play tricks on the ground. They got to play tricks in your heart. They got to play tricks in your mind. They got to play tricks with your eyes, with what you hear, with what you see, with what you eat. Because it's breaking you down for that big ah moment, you know? I got one more for you before we get out of here. The great breakdown, you know? Scientific show today. So I figured that we needed a scientific explanation, you know, before we give the most to the most. You deal with what I'm talking about? So let's go ahead and get into it because this is a lengthy show. This is the last one, and this is a pretty lengthy audio clip itself, 20 minutes. So let's go ahead and listen to what they got to say. Very valuable information. Thanks again for tuning in. More Art Radio.
Welcome to Blackstone Intelligence. I'm Jake Morfonios. From approximately 1100 to 1300, the Knights Templars spread their power, their wealth, and their influence across Europe. Among their activities was the financing of beautiful churches, beautiful cathedrals, all throughout the continent. These structures were built by craft guilds. Now, what were these guilds? How did they get started? Let's go way back in time. Sacred geometry is the study of sacred truths as found in certain geometric proportions that are found not only in nature, but throughout the entire cosmos. The geometric patterns present in nature lend support to the creation of our physical reality by an intelligent designer. The ancients took their knowledge of sacred geometry and they passed it down through the ages, through the various mystery schools and mystic traditions. Along the way, this knowledge has been used, among other things, to create stunning architecture by people. And it's believed that these geometric patterns are the physical manifestations of the invisible energy patterns that weave together to manifest what we know as reality. The ancient Egyptian texts and wall illustrations present an initiation process whereby men may become masters of these energy patterns, enabling them to do things that are perceived as magical. The Egyptians also believed that to die without this sacred knowledge would entrap the soul in a kind of spiritual net. But with the initiation into the mysteries and a subsequent mastery of this sacred knowledge, a soul would be able to navigate his way through the non-corporeal afterlife. The Egyptian god Thoth was said to be the master of this spiritual net, the net being a kind of energy-space-time matrix that constituted the unseen spiritual world. The Egyptian Book of the Dead, known to the people of ancient Egypt as the Book of Coming Forth into the Light, describes this net in detail. The initiate is to consider himself as one with Osiris, the slain god who was brought back to life. And by going through the same spiritual process as Osiris, the initiate is able to navigate to higher and higher spiritual realms and conquer death itself. Now, these teachings of the Egyptian mystery schools, including the teachings about sacred geometry, eventually became part of the mystery schools of ancient Greece and later Israel. The ancient Greeks incorporated numerology and sacred geometry into their mystery schools and into their Gnostic texts. This included their teachings about the existence of the net, or this invisible energy field, and the need for mortals in the physical realm to align themselves with the realm of the spirit. Sacred geometry was most certainly used by the Greeks in their temple architecture. And like Israel, Greece had a numerical system that corresponded with their alphabet, a system known as gematria. It was believed that words and names produced certain vibrational qualities, kind of like a tuning fork, that corresponded to various types of energy and power. When the Greeks built a temple, for example, they translated the name of the god to whom the temple was going to be dedicated into its corresponding numerical or numerological values, and these numbers were used to design and measure that temple. In Israel, the knowledge of sacred geometry became incorporated with the teachings of Kabbalah. The most well-known representation of this teaching is called the Tree of Life. Part of these esoteric teachings place heavy emphasis on certain numbers, including the numbers 3, 7, and 12. The Bible is brimming with references to these numbers, such as the three member of the Godhead, or the 7 days of creation, and the 12 apostles. These numbers are significant in the teachings of Kabbalah, which stress things such as the three key anchors for the astral body, or the human soul, the head, the heart, and the belly area. The 7 anchors of the etheric body are mentioned, and the 12 anchors of the physical body. Those familiar with Hebrew or with the so-called Bible code know that the importance that words and numbers play in this, that they correspond together to form hidden ideas or meanings, a type of biblical numerology. Well, sacred geometry was used in the construction of Israel's first permanent temple, which was known as the Temple of Solomon. Kabbalah teaches that the design of the temple represented the metaphysical world and was an earthly representation of the Tree of Life through which the Creator reveals His truth. According to the Bible, King Solomon asked the neighboring king of Tyre, a man named Hiram, to help him build the temple by providing building materials and laborers. This story is recorded in the book of 1 Kings. Hiram had been a friend to Solomon's father, David, and so he gladly lent his help. But by the time the temple was completed, Solomon was so deeply in debt to King Hiram that he had to give to the king of Tyre 20 Israeli towns in northern Galilee. The building project was allegedly so large that Solomon ordered and utilized a forced labor of people. 30,000 men were sent to cut logs for the temple, 80,000 to cut stones out of the hill country, 70,000 men to carry the stones, and thousands more to work on crafting the stones into usable blocks. The book of 1 Kings speaks of another man named Hiram who was involved in the building of this temple. He was the son of a widow. He was a master craftsman. Hiram, the widow's son, was in charge of casting the bronze furnishings and ornate decorations for the temple. This man is referred to as Hiram Abiff, or Hiram Abiff, by Freemasons, and he's the central character in the Masonic rituals. In Masonry, Hiram is credited as being the chief architect of Solomon's temple, and his character plays the role in Masonic mystery teachings that was played by Osiris in the ancient Egyptian mystery schools. By the time that Solomon had finished building the temple, it was over 20 stories tall. The temple had two enormous pillars made of some kind of metal, copper, brass, or bronze. These pillars were named Boaz and Yakin. They had intricate carvings and ornamentation full of symbolism, such as hundreds of ivory pomegranates. Pomegranates, of course, are symbols of sacred geometry that go back to the time of Egypt. This fruit was used in Egyptian funerary ceremonies, and carved pomegranates have been found in the tombs of the Egyptian kings. There's plenty of other evidence that the ancient Temple of Solomon incorporated elements of the esoteric mysteries and sacred geometry that were taught by these ancient mystery schools. Later, Islamic tradition, specifically talking about Sufism, also incorporated these spiritual initiation teachings and numerology and sacred geometry. One example is the Sufi emphasis on the power of the number 19. This harkens back to ancient Egyptian temple science. One of the primary geometric grids used by the ancient Egyptians to lay out designs on their temple walls was based on 19 vertical divisions. The mystery schools taught that the number 19 is built into the energy blueprint in all human beings, and that it exists through all creation. Well, this energy blueprint is connected not only to chakras, but to other energy centers. This is what the ancient Egyptian texts referred to as the golden light. So these various mystical traditions kept alive the ancient teachings of sacred geometry, including their architectural applications. In fact, the famous English classicist Robert Graves said that his studies indicated that it was from the 10th century Sufi builders who developed Cordoba in Moorish Spain that the medieval French craft guilds came into being. These craft guilds spread from France to England and most notably into Scotland. Because of the great significance that craft guilds played in the development of Freemasonry, let's take just a couple of moments here and discuss what a craft guild was. Medieval craft guilds were groups of people who worked together in the same craft or trade, who banded together for mutual benefit. They were somewhat similar to today's trade unions, but these guilds were a whole lot more than that, much more tightly knit. They often had their own meeting places called guild halls. Some of them even formed their own secret societies to protect their craft secrets. There are all kinds of craft guilds. One example were the metalworking guilds. And even within the general metalworking genre were specific guilds for knife makers, for locksmiths, chain forgers, nail makers, armorers. Another kind of guild, the one which we are most concerned with ourselves here, were the stonemasons. Each guild closely protected the secrets of their craft from people outside of the guild. A guild member who was found guilty of exposing secrets outside of his brotherhood to unauthorized or uninitiated people was subjected to either fines, banishment, sometimes even to death. The way the craft guilds passed on their secrets was through a system of hierarchies. In the case of craft masons, the most common hierarchy was the three stages of apprentice, fellow craftsman, and master mason. Once a new person entered the craft as an apprentice, he would spend years learning the trade by working with at least one or more initiated fellow craftsmen, who were also called companions. If the apprentice was to eventually be found worthy to receive higher knowledge of the craft, he would be put through an initiation ceremony and greater secrets of the craft would be taught to him, for example, lessons on sacred geometry. The most disciplined and faithful could eventually go on to become master masons. So this system today is referred to as operative masonry because the men were actually carving blocks of stone with real tools and creating beautiful structures. But in time, the structure of this system would also be used in what is known as speculative masonry, what we today call Freemasonry. Freemasons also have the entry-level degrees of apprentice, fellow craft, and master mason, and they also teach initiates how to use the tools of the trade, but rather than crafting beauty out of physical stones, Freemasons are said to use the tools of the craft to turn the rough stones of their souls into beautiful blocks to be used in the service of the great architect of the universe, who is God. I'll discuss the philosophy of speculative masonry in greater depth in a future video, but let's return to medieval France. There were three primary Masonic craft guilds at this time. One was called the Children of Father Soubise. They primarily used Romanesque-style architecture. Next was the guild called the Children of Master Jacques. Master Jacques was an ancient figure whose father, a man named Jachin, had served his own apprenticeship in Greece, in Egypt, and also in Jerusalem. The tradition of this guild is that Jachin was the very man who had built the two pillars of the Temple of Solomon, with one of the pillars being named after him. But now we come to the most significant of these three medieval Mason craft guilds, the Children of Solomon. These are the ones who were deeply linked to the Knights Templar. If the legend is correct, the original Knights Templar who excavated the Temple Mount discovered ancient texts containing mysteries of sacred geometry, among other discoveries. The Knights Templar brought this knowledge back to France, where it was studied by the Cistercian monks under Bernard of Clairvaux. And it was these Cistercians who taught a new form of architecture based on sacred geometry to the Children of Solomon. Some actually speculate that the Children of Solomon were actually a division within the order of the Knights Templar rather than a standalone craft guild. What we do know is that in 1145 AD, the powerful Knights Templar issued an order that all of Europe accept the authority of the Children of Solomon. The historical document reads like this, quote, "We, the Knights of Christ and of the Temple, follow the destiny that prepares us to die for Christ. We have the wish to give this rule of living, of work, and of honor to the constructors of church, that Christianity can spread throughout the earth, not so that our name should be remembered, O Lord, but so that your name should live." This protective order meant that, like the Templars themselves, the members of this guild could travel unmolested, that they were not required to pay taxes to any king, and that they were immune from legal prosecution. So with these powers, the Masonic guild known as the Children of Solomon constructed a new world throughout Europe. Using this new form of architecture called Gothic, the Children of Solomon built up magnificent churches and cathedrals. Perhaps in a future video I can devote more attention to the incredible symbolism and architectural majesty of some of these buildings. These were not simply places of worship, but they were also used for secular purposes. Things such as functioning as sanctuaries. They were temporary hospitals, public theaters, and so on. One of the more famous cathedrals built by the Templars Children of Solomon Craft Guild is the Chartres Cathedral that is in France. The sublime architecture with its rich symbolism is a sermon unto itself. Over the centuries, thousands of pilgrims and visitors have reported being spiritually uplifted and even transformed by the power that the buildings inspired in their hearts. Regardless of the opinion that one may hold of Freemasonry, the Catholic Church, or religion in general, there simply is no denying that hundreds of esoteric messages were gracefully etched into these stones by master craftsmen, men who faithfully guarded the secrets of their craft that were based upon ancient mystic knowledge. One can easily see the liberal use of sacred geometry in the structure and building and design of these buildings. Nor can it be denied that the works of these Christians are strikingly similar to the works of their Muslim cousins. Sufism had long carried these same secrets over the centuries, handing them down from one generation to the next. So it's no surprise, therefore, that the mystery school teachings of the Sufis in Moorish Spain were very similar to the teachings of their neighbors in their Christian Gnostic neighbors, who had adopted much of the knowledge that they had from the Kabbalah and from Jewish mysticism. And because all of these various traditions came from the same ancient sources, they were bound to meld together. Those familiar with Freemasonry know that the order intermingles the esoteric teachings from not only Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, but also from the ancient sources that informed the mystical traditions of those major religions. And here we must return once again to Rex Deus. Those powerful families that claimed to have descended from Jerusalem before its destruction in 70 AD. While the Knights Templar and its notable Craftmason Guild were certainly products of the Rex Deus families, so too were the infamous Sagas of the Holy Grail, stories of heretical origin that claimed not only that members of Rex Deus were descendants of Jewish high priests, but also that some of them were direct blood descendants of Jesus himself through a marriage union with Mary Magdalene. So in our next episode, we will delve into the mysterious labyrinth of these highly controversial Grail sagas. For Blackstone Intelligence, I'm Jake Morfonios.
Figured out how to blend in with my boy music. Blackstone Intelligence. Yes, sir, yes, sir, yes, sir. That's good information, though. Secrets of geometry. You know? I say it's the hidden language. You know, the world that we build. When they came across my desk that you can either build heaven or you can either build earth. That was powerful for me. May not be powerful for a lot of people, but was definitely powerful for me. Grabbing my phone. The video before Blackstone Intelligence was brought to us by a YouTube video called Seeker. Yeah, they brought down CERN. I reached back to grab my phone, made sure that I gave them the proper credit that they need. Want to start giving credit when credit is due. But hey, that's today's show. You went. Put it on your heart, your mind, body, soul, and use the information however you feel, because guess what? These are the things that are going on in the world around you. So, either you're just going to let it happen to you, going to stand up and fight about it, do something about it. If you don't do anything, you can't cry. You know? So, information being presented thanks to all of the people that helped, you know, worked on that craft, made them available, that encouraged people to share them. Mine as well, share it. If you see it beneficial, share it. You know, whole objective is to win souls. Be ashamed to live all of eternity and a lot of the people you love ain't there to spend it with you, you know. But on that note, thank the Lord for the day, the moment, and the hour. I pray blessings over me, my friends, your families, your neighbors, those that are not here, those that are here. The reason that I pray for me first is so that you can pray for you first. It's the best way to cover somebody else to first be prayed over, right? By way of Yahweh Shai. That's how we do it, love, fam. One. Until next time, Move Out Radio.
Yeah. I just want to be clear. They're right here. My producer gone. 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 Felt like that nigga did me wrong. Shit, he left me home. My producer gone. My producer gone. My producer gone. So I made the song. Shit, I had to jack the track. I didn't want to do that. Yeah. But I need to spit some crack. And he didn't leave me nothing to do that. So I had to find a song. Cause I had to spit on. My nigga left me home alone. So I had to find a song to spit on. That nigga did me wrong. He left me alone. My producer gone. My producer gone. My producer gone. My producer gone. So I made the song. Cause he left me home. And I'm on my own. Yeah. My producer gone. 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 That nigga did me wrong. My producer gone, and I'm on my own. So I need a franchise and find other niggas that got crack that I can spit on. You got shit at home, nigga, come on and send them on. Cause I need that, cause I got crack, crack, and crack, and crack. And more crack, yeah. I need it, bitch. I need it, yeah. I need it, yeah. I need it. My producer gone, my producer gone, my producer gone, my producer gone. Now I'm on my own. If you got something that I can spit on, send it on. Come on, send it on, yeah. Send it on. Cause my producer gone. 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 Shit, he did me wrong. And I'm on my own. My producer gone. Yeah.